At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify requirements for chairing a meeting at Central Orlando Group. Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at a group conscious meeting. And it took me three meetings. I had to come to three business meetings to be able to share the May speakers meeting. So this is kind of misleading, but that's okay. All I can tell you is that as soon as I started drinking when I was 13, 14 years old, after that I broke all kind of laws, you know, God's laws, civil laws, immigration laws, you name it, you know. And nothing changed until I ended up in AA. And it's been 17 years since my last drink, and I'm grateful for AA and for you all and all your support and your friendship and all the friends that I've made here through the years. Thank you. At this time, I'm going to introduce our speaker for tonight. His name is Keon. I met Keon about 2.5 years ago. He doesn't know, but I think he helped me more during that time than what I helped him, because I was having financial difficulties at the time, the fear of losing my business, and you know, my all the material things, you know. And I remember that I was coming to meetings, but I was lost, you know. My mind was someplace else. And I remember he was new, and him and other people, and I used to hang out with them, and that really helped me a lot, because I got out of myself, and I was able to listen to them and you know, to practice what I'm supposed to practice here. And I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful that I had to meet him over, you know, the years, and he's grown. He's come a long way. He comes every day. And, you know, I am not a movie person, but Keon has introduced me to movies and stuff like that, and I really appreciate that, because I've seen some good films at his house. So with that, I'm going to introduce Keon. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Keon. I'm an alcoholic. Can everybody hear me back there? My sobriety date is December 9th, 2007, and that's through the grace of God and Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people in this room here. I'm just going to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope, you know, since I've been in this program. As many of you know, I was born in Ireland, and I've lost my accent, obviously, but it comes back every once in a while. And, you know, I moved here when I was 12 or 11 or 12. I think I'd get that age right, but you know, I was still drinking, you know, but even at the young age of 12, you know, I had a wonderful family. My parents are, you know, very loving parents. I had a wonderful sister, you know, and, you know, they're not alcoholic. My parents aren't. My sister's not. Nobody in my immediate family is. You know, my parents are just, you know, I have this thing, and that's just the way it is. And, you know, when we were growing up, you know, there was no alcohol in the house. There was nobody over drinking or anything like that. But there was still this, you know, environment of, you know, where I still felt like something's wrong with me. Like I didn't feel like I belonged. I've heard a lot of people share that. And, you know, some of that had to do with the fact that, you know, I felt like I wasn't good enough of a son, you know, to my parents. I felt like my parents weren't happy with me. Like I wasn't accomplishing. Microphone. I felt like I wasn't accomplishing enough, you know. And you know, like I'd be going to school and I'd be doing my best, and I'd take my report card home and my parents would see it and they'd be like, "Well, you know, it's 3 A's and a B. That's not 4 A's. So you know, it's not quite what we expect out of you." You know, it was very. That was always communicated to me that, you know, we want you to be like, you know, it had this very high expectation for me, and I felt like I was never, you know, reaching that expectation. So I always felt like I was, you know, I never felt like I was adequate. And the drinking, you know, started around as early as 12. When I was 11, I'd had my confirmation, and I was raised Catholic, obviously, in Ireland, and they had this pledge you take saying, you know, I pledge I'm not going to drink till I'm 18. And I remember being in church, like, and the bishop, you know, asked, because I guess it was optional, he'd say, who here wants to take the pledge? You know, just stand up and we'll bless you. And I was, you know, I had cousins who were 15, three cousins, Dermot Manis and Derek, and they were like my older brothers, because I didn't have brothers. And I knew they were already drinking, you know, and they had already broken their pledge. So I was like, I don't want to take this pledge, you know, this is like, this is for losers. And so I didn't go to stand up, and my dad, he was like, get up there, you bastard, you know, like, and so he really elbowed me, and like, I stood up and, you know, obviously took this pledge. And I remember, like, I still remember where I was. I was like 12 or 13 when my one cousin Dermot, he offered me like some wine or champagne in the summer while we're hanging out. And I remember telling him, like, oh no, I can't have that, you know, I've taken this pledge, you know, cause it was really instilled in me, you know, that faith was important and, you know, this is an important thing, you know, God will be upset with you if you drink, you know, you have to keep this pledge. And, you know, and I remember refusing alcohol a couple of times because I was like, no, I'm taking this. But, you know, there came the time when eventually I just said, you know, screw it. You know, and I was like about 12, and my cousins were 15, and I just decided, hey, let's get drunk, you know, and they planned the whole thing. I remember specifically we were in this, like, you know, vacation area on the beach, and we walked, like, you know, there was one road in, one road out, you know, so, and we couldn't walk. It was a store, it was about 5 miles away, you know, and we had to go to that store so our parents wouldn't see us. So, you know, we snuck all the way, like, down the beach and, like, cut 4 miles across fields to get to this, like, 7-Eleven to get apple cider, it was. I don't know if they drink it here or not, but, you know, I got a 2-liter of that. It was called Linden Village Apple Cider. It was like 6% alcohol, and I drank probably 3/4 of it. I was 12, and I just puked all over the place. And my cousins were just, you know, laughing about the whole thing. They were 15. They were already, like, expert drinkers. And, you know, at the time I was drinking, I got this feeling like, wow, you know, like, it felt great. I didn't feel like I was inadequate or, you know, like I was an inadequate kid or, like, my parents, you know, that feeling I always got when I was with my parents that I wasn't accomplishing enough. And so, you know, I was like, I like this drinking thing, even though I, you know, puked all over the place. Couldn't wait to do it again. But for me, it was like my parents were so strict. I mean, they had me, like, they knew I was up to no good. So they never let me out of the house. I mean, I was like, the windows were like bar and chain on them. And they had me, like, you know, didn't let me do anything. And so I didn't really get to drink again until I went to college at 17. And I was here at Winter Park at Rollins College. And I just was like, all right, this is great. Now, you know, the shackles are off. The parties are going on. And it was just like, have at it. And I just was getting, like, drunk, you know, every weekend. And, but at the same time, you know, I was still, you know, I have to make my parents proud. You know, I have to get good grades in school. So it was like on the weekends, I would be drinking like 12 hours every night. And then during the week, I'd be like studying 12 hours a day, you know, because I have to do good in school to make mommy and daddy happy. And, that just got to a point where, you know, I believe I was what, you know, the book calls a hard drinker at that point, because I was drinking and I was getting drunk every time, but I wasn't, you know, going, you know, I wasn't blacking out. I wasn't passing out. I wasn't forgetting what happened. I was getting drunk when I drank, but it wasn't to the point of, like, beyond, you know, comprehension and what the book talks about for alcoholics. And, you know, and that continued for a while, and then after there, I went to graduate school, and that's where, summer of 2001, I can almost, it happened within a matter of weeks. I went from, like, you know, drinking, you know, I'd be able to drink six and stop and be like, okay, I feel drunk, I'm feeling good, to, in the summer of 2001, it just, I went from that to, like, no control whatsoever. You know, once I took that first drink, it was just, I could not stop at all, and I was just, like, getting beyond drunk, you know, blacking out every time, not remembering what happened. People were saying, I remember, like, at a beach party, people were, the first hint of it was a girl that would tell me,
you know, I was asking her a question. I was like, tell me about that again. And she's like, this is the third time you've asked me. You don't remember I told you the story twice yet last night. You know, like, that was the first time where I was like, man, my drinking maybe is getting out of control here. And, that you know, then the same time a week later, this is also in the summer of 2001, I blacked out, I woke up, and my friends were like, hey, Kian, that was pretty crazy. You were like swimming like a quarter mile down the beach last night at like 3 a.m. And I was like, I was doing what? You know, swimming in an ocean is something you'd probably remember doing. I mean, it's not like, you know, going outside and talking to somebody. I mean, it requires a lot of activity. You know, you get wet and, you know, the water's cold, but no, none of that remembered at all. And my friend told me that the next morning. And then it continued, it got even worse. Like when I was up at Tallahassee in school, like I remember I woke up one morning and I had like a scratch like all across my face, across my chin, like that long. And I looked in the mirror and I was like, how the hell did that get on my face? And just one second. And I asked, I went to the library, I was like doing a homework assignment or whatever, and some guy yells, like he was probably where Angel is, he's like, hey, Kian, how would you enjoy, he's like, you don't remember getting nuts, you don't remember, like, you know, falling down the 100 steps outside Sloppy Joe's last night? And I was like, you know, he just yelled it in the library, and he's, you know, in front of, there's like 100 people in the library, and I was just like, just frozen stiff, because I had no idea how I got this huge scar on my chin. And the night before, I remember going out drinking, and I remember waking up in my bed, and I remember seeing this huge scar on my face. But when he just yelled at it, you know, across to me in the library, it was just like, you know, something's going on here with my drinking. My drinking's out of control, and you know, I vaguely sensed something was wrong, but I didn't know what to do about it. I was like, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'll just keep drinking. You know, something's wrong, but it's like it's not. You know, what am I supposed to do? You know, it's just, it was okay 2 months ago. I mean, I was drinking 6-pack, you know, feeling drunk and feeling great. And now it's like, I can't control anything. It's just happened like literally almost overnight. And so, that continued and it all kind of, for me, it hit like a bottom in September 7th of 2001 when I went to this beer fest in downtown Tallahassee. They had a beer fest and I drank a crap load of beer and then I went to this friend's house. He was making mixed drinks at his house, and I don't know, you know, how much he would drink, how much alcohol he's putting in the drinks. I mean, it may have been a lot, but whatever, it doesn't matter. I apparently, this is what I was told from witnesses who were there, because I don't remember. I went out in the front yard and I was just standing there, kind of wavering, and then I just kind of keeled over in the front yard, and they carried me like to someone's, you know, someone's apartment, and just put me on a couch, and were like, oh, just leave him there, he'll be fine, you know. You know, I mean, I've done that with like, you know, lots of my friends. You know, a lot of my friends drink a lot, and, you know, they'd pass out, and you'd put them on the couch, he'll be fine in the morning. And then somebody, my friend Ronnie, he was just looking at me, and he said to my other friends, he's like, I don't know, he just doesn't look right. Something, I don't know, they're like, maybe we should call an ambulance. And then my other friend, they got in a fight. One of them was like, are you crazy? You're going to call an ambulance? You're going to humiliate him, you know? He'll find out, he'll go to school, and everyone's going to know about it, and he's going to kick your butt, you know, like. And my one friend's like, no, he doesn't look right. I'm going to call an ambulance. And so they did. And, you know, lucky he did, because on the way to the hospital, you know, I woke up in the hospital anyway. And, apparently, you know, my blood alcohol was like over 3. I think it was like 3.5 or something. But, the next day, like my friend who called 911, he goes, hey, Kian, I was walking into class with him and he goes, hey, Kian, you know, he's like, I'm friends with that paramedic who's in the, a lot of you have probably already heard the story, but he goes, I'm friends with the paramedic, you know, who was in the ambulance with you? And I was like, yeah? And he goes, yeah. He's like, they said they had to stop, they had to pull the ambulance over like 3 times on the way to the hospital, you know, because you stop breathing and they had to, you know, get out the, you know, they had to revive you 3 times on the way to the hospital, you know, you just quit, you know? And he's like, not just once, not twice, but 3 times they had to stop the ambulance. And I was just like, I was standing outside the class, you know, I had to walk into class. It was like Friday morning or whatever, and I just like the books fell out of my hand. And he's like, "Well, I gotta go. Class about to start. I'll see you later." And everybody just runs into class, and I'm just standing in the hallway by myself. And I was just like, I mean, that feeling, like, you know, they say, you know, you'll hit a bottom, and that was definitely a bottom. And you'd think I would have stopped drinking, but, I didn't stop drinking. That wasn't enough for me. But the fact of the matter was, you know, that basically told me, you know, that and I had no, people asked me a lot, they're like, were you doing drugs? What kind of drugs? I was like, no, just alcohol. It's just alcohol. And that's what the scary thing was for me. But, after that, the next day, I went back to the hospital to talk to a guy who was, an addictions counselor, and I think he may have had some connections with AA, and he basically, long story short, he explained to me, he's like, you know, you may be an alcoholic, and he's like, if you are, you know, you may have this thing called an allergy, where, you know, your body does not treat alcohol the same as a normal person. And, you know, I know this is not in our big book, but the way, what was told to me, and this is what got me to AA, was he said, you know, the normal person, you know, they take the alcohol and they convert it to, their liver converts it to acetone, which then converts it to like carbon dioxide and water, or sugar and water. He's like, and if you're an alcoholic, your liver just takes the alcohol, converts it to acetone, and it doesn't do that last step. The acetone gets released, and that's like a neurotoxin, and that's what makes you can't stop drinking. And that was kind of like, that makes a lot of sense. That's probably why I can't, you know, control my drinking. And he suggested I go to an AA meeting, and I did. I went to an AA meeting in 2001 in Tallahassee, and the first thought I got when I walked in the door was, I was like, the youngest person in there was, besides me, was about 55. And I was 23. And so my initial reaction was, you know, I'm in the wrong place. I mean, I'm not 55. I don't belong here. This is not for me. And, but you know, I decided to stay just to listen to what they had to say. And there's a guy in the book called, Fred. And I identify a lot with him because, you know, he came to AA and he, you know, he listened to what they had to say, but he said, you know, I don't think I'm as bad as you guys. You know, I think I can quit this thing on my own. And, you know, thanks for the information kind of thing. And that's what I did. I said no thanks. And I left AA and, I said, you know, I'm so humiliated by what's happened to me. I don't want to drink, you know. I admit that, you know, I have this thing you guys call an allergy where basically once I take that first drink, I have no control. I will always want a second drink. I'll always want a third drink. I'll always want a fourth drink. And I'll keep drinking until I pass out or black out or whatever. But you guys are telling me that also I have this mental obsession of the mind where you're staying telling me I can't quit on my own willpower. And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to drink now. You know, I'm not as bad as you guys. I really think I can quit on my own. And they're like, okay, you know what? Then maybe you can, you know, and I had a sponsor at the time. I mean, he gave me a big book and he wrote his name in it and everything. And I met with him a couple of times, but, you know, I just didn't think I needed to do, you know, I mean, I saw all these steps on the wall. I saw made a decision to turn my will over to the care of God as I understand him, and making a searching and fearless moral inventory. I was just like, I don't need to do all this. I don't want to drink anymore. I mean, it's just, so anyway, I came down to Orlando here and I didn't drink for, 6 years. I didn't take any, didn't have one drink at all. And, one of the main reasons for that was like, I didn't have a lot of, it's kind of like there's another guy, another story in the big book, a guy who doesn't drink for 25 years. And it says in the big book, like one of the reasons he doesn't take a drink was he said he wouldn't be successful in business at all if he took a drink. You know, so he decided, hey, you know, I'm going to wait until I retire and then I'll get drunk. You know, we'll wait until I have some money or whatever. And that was my thinking was. My thinking was, you know, I'm just going to go down, get a job, go down to Orlando, and I'm not going to drink because I can't, you know, my money is very important to me. I was a very selfish, financially selfish person, you know. I wanted to get a lot of money and work, and, you know, that was what I was all about, to try and impress my parents. And so that was why I really didn't take that drink for so long. But, you know, that day did come. The people in 2001, the guys in AA told me, they said, if you're like us, you know, you will drink again. You have in the mind of an alcoholic. And they were right. It was actually September 2007. I was at my house, and there was tons of beer in my fridge. There'd been beer in my fridge for like five years, because I told friends, they're like, you don't drink, right? I don't want to bring beer over. Like, I was like, no, bring it over. I'm not going to touch it, you know. And they did. They left beer in my fridge, and they left the beer there. And then that day, September, it was like September, about 6 years after the last time I drank, I just said to myself, look, you know, there's beer in the fridge. Great. My favorite TV show is on. This is great. I'm just going to take a drink, and I'm just going to have one beer. And I did. And of course, as you guys know, the story ended with me having a second drink and a third drink and more until I, you know, passed out and blacked out again. I was right back where I started from 6 years later. Even though I had no drinks, my disease was 10 times worse, 100 times worse, because now I wanted to drink every day. You know, my mental obsession was like 100 times strong. So even though I hadn't taken any drinks for 6 years, once I took that drink, it was just like every day I wanted another one, another one, another one. And that's when I really came down to Central, because I was like, you know, I'd already had that seed planted in my head from 2001 where that, you know, I'd been to AA and the guys had told me, look, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you'll have its mental and physical condition. So I came down here, and this time I, you know, got a sponsor and tried to work the steps. But when I first came down here, I wasn't very good at asking for help. I remember standing outside the door there, outside that front door we walk out by that gray garbage can. I was standing there and I was like, I mean, you would have looked at me, you'd have been like, this guy is just about to shoot himself. and that's the way it was. I mean, I had a great job, a great house, you know, great car, but I wanted to blow my brains out. And it was because finally, you know, for the first time in my life, I had no idea what to do. You know, I didn't have the key in plan anymore, because I couldn't quit on my own willpower. I knew that because I took that drink. And I know that that was an insane thing for me to do, knowing what happens to me when I drink. So I didn't have the key in plan, and I knew I couldn't drink. So if I know I can't quit and I know I can't drink, then now it's like I have to ask for help. And I'm not good for asking for help, because my ego is extremely big. So I stood out there, and I went to several meetings, and, you know, and I didn't go up to anybody. And finally, some guy came over to me, and he goes, are you all right, man? You don't look so good. And it was after the 8 o'clock meeting, and it was December 9th, because I wasn't a one white chip wonder here either. And I said, I'm okay, you know. And he's like, really? So you don't look so good. You know, this guy, you know, he understood, like, because he'd been there before. And he's like, you know, you want to get a cup of coffee, you know, after the meeting? And I was like, you know, I still was trying to pretend like I was okay, you know, even though he knew and I knew that I was like, you know, about to kill myself. And I was like, yeah, you know, sure, whatever, you know. I mean, I was trying to pretend like I was all with it when I wasn't. And we went down to get coffee, long story short. And, you know, he talked to me from like 9:30 till like 1:30 in the morning. And about every 20 minutes, I'd look at my watch and I'd say, hey man, you know, it's like midnight. I mean, it's like 12:30. Hey man, it's like 1 o'clock. And I remember I'd always say, it's getting kind of late. I go, do you need to go? And he'd always give me the same answer. He goes, that depends on you. You know, because he was there answering my questions, talking to me, helping me out. And he could see, you know, that I was in desperate need, because he could see that I was just dumbstruck. And so, you know, we read more about alcoholism, and, you know, he read a little bit about, you know, he's like, are you powerless over alcohol? And, you know, and my ego was still like, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I got this mental thing, but see the physical thing, and I was, you know, I try and, like, you know, intellectualize everything, and I'm right and you're wrong. And then he was just like, oh, really? Wow, sounds like you're good then. You know, and that was good for me, because he was the first guy who was able to really just call me on my crap. And every time I would say, well, you know, here's why I don't think I have the mental part, because, you know, I was able to quit for 6 years. I mean, that's a long time. He's like, oh, so you've gone, you haven't taken a drink then? Oh no, I took a drink a week ago. So you do have a mental problem then? And I was like, well, you know, and so that. He was instrumental, and he actually, then the next day, I think it was, or the day before, he introduced me to somebody, and he's like, you know, this guy's a great sponsor, you know, hint, hint. You know, he didn't say, go get him as a sponsor. He didn't say, you know, you must do this. He's like, here's a great guy, you know. And then I said, well, could he be a sponsor? He's like, well, he could be one, you know. And so I just went up to the guy after the meeting, and I was like, you know, because anything this guy said, I trusted this guy. And I was like, hey, man, will you be my sponsor? And the guy's like, sure, yeah. He's like, do you have a book, you know? And, you know, he got me a book. I told him I already had a book. And he told me, he's like, let's meet, this Thursday, 7 o'clock. And here's where I live, you know. And he's like, just read the first chapter, you know. And that's what I did. And I, you know, we went through the steps together. And the first part, you know, admitting I'm powerless over alcohol, that was something that, you know, I kind of already knew from the physical and mental part of the disease. I mean, I knew that I had this physical allergy, this physical craving. Once I took a drink, you know, I had no control. I had to keep having wanting the next one and the next one. And the mental part, that was something that, you know, I knew too, because knowing what I know about, knowing what happens to me when I drink, and I still took that first drink, I knew I can't stay stopped. I can't quit on my own willpower. But the second part of the first step was something I was like, how is my life unmanageable? You know, it's like, because I was like, I've never been arrested. I've never had a DUI. You know, I've never lost a house or a job or a family or anything. And, you know, the bottom line is that the sponsor had, he's like, well, but can you predict the outcome, you know, when you drink? And I was like, no. He's like, well, you did end up in hospital. I mean, look at that. Look what happens to you. He's like, you have no ability to predict the outcome, what happens to you when you drink. And I mean, I had to concede that, you know. I mean, it was true that, so for me, you know, my life wasn't manageable, because when I drink, there's no predictable outcome for me. Anything could happen. And then, came to believe that a power was greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You know, I didn't like the word sanity, because I presumed I was insane. But the sponsor told me, he's like, you know, the word sanity comes from the Latin, I guess, for wholeness. And so he explained to me, you know, we're not saying that you're like insane, like some people use the word. It's saying that, you know, it's like a pie with a piece missing. You know, all these other areas of my life, you know, maybe they'll make pretty decent decisions. You know, I mean, when I drive a car, you know, I usually don't, you know, just swear off and hit people on the sidewalk, or, you know, when I'm going to drink, you know, I don't pour water down the back of my hand, you know, back of my shirt. But, you know, when it comes to alcohol, it's just, I don't make reasonable, sound decisions. So he's like, you're just, you know, your intellect's like a piece of pie with a, you know, it's like a pie with a piece missing. And that's, and, you know, for me, that was a lot easier to swallow, you know. And I always believed in a God. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and you know, I just started praying to that God, to relieve me of this obsession and turning my life over to it in the third step. But for me, it was just, that always triggered like my childhood and the fact that I was raised in the faith. And for me, it wasn't a positive experience. I mean, for me. So I had to find, you know, power, a God of my own understanding. And that took some time. I mean, I talked to some people, who had a similar experience with me after meetings and in the fellowship. And some of them recommended, you know, things to read and ways to pray. And that really helped. And, you know, with time, I was able to develop a higher power of my own understanding, as opposed to, you know, a God of, you know, my parents' understanding or someone else's understanding. And, so when I went to pray, you know, at night and say the third step prayer, you know, God, I offer myself to thee, and do with me as thou wilt, you know, it was a lot easier for me to pray to, you know, the higher power of my own understanding than, you know, the higher power of my childhood, which I would always, you know, remember those memories of, you know, in Ireland, you know, it's pretty hardcore where I grew up, and some of the priests were pretty, you know, thumping the podium. And so anyway, the fourth step, doing a search, making a searching and fearless moral inventory. One second here. You know, my sponsor, he had me get a folder and a pen, obviously, to write the inventory in. And I remember, you know, just, I dragged my heels on the fourth step. You know, he just asked me simply, he said, just make a list and of people who you're resentful at, and I did that. And then I brought it back to him, and he goes, 25? He's like, no, you're gonna get way more than that. And I was like, okay, how does this guy know how many people I'm resentful at? But he was right. I ended up with like 130 something or whatever. Because, you know, some of them were little things. Some of them were like, you know, people on TV. I mean, you know, people I've never met. And, but I dragged it because, like, I'd meet with them once a week, and sometimes I would just do, like, as you guys know, there's, like, four columns in the fourth step. I would do, like, the first column one week, and then the second column another week, and the third column a third week. And so I was dragging it out, you know, just doing those four columns was taking me, like, a month, when I could have just done it all in, like, 1 week. You know, and I'd go to meet with him, and he'd say, oh, well, you could have done more than that. I mean, you know, it's, and that was another thing, too, was he asked me first, he first asked me, just make a list of people you're resentful at. I didn't do anything. He's like, did you do anything? I go, no. And he goes, all right, now we're going to have to set, you know, Thursday, by Thursday at 8 o'clock, have a list of people you're resentful at. Because for me, I was just, until I was given a date and time to actually have it done, I was just like, this isn't very important. You know, I was still kind of dragging my feet. And, but I eventually made the list of the people I was resentful at, and looking at my part in it, the fact that, you know, for each person, you know, how does this affect me? And I saw for each person, it always, you know, there was, I was always worried about myself, either my self-centeredness, or, you know, I had, my self-esteem was damaged, or, you know, I was always self-centered, my self-centeredness was being threatened by certain people. So that was, seeing that on paper was eye-opening for me, because before it was just all up in here and there was just no way to see it on paper. But, so when I finished all the fear and the fear inventory also and the sex inventory, I met with my sponsor and we did the fifth step. And at that point, you know, I told him, you know, I just told him everything. And, you know, I liked how at the beginning of it, he first said, he's like, let's invite God here. Even though God's already here, we're going to invite God, you know, to this discussion. And that was kind of like, I mean, I thought that was kind of cool. But, then he told me some of his stuff. He was like, you know, I've been like a 10-time convicted felon and I've done this. And I was like, that really made me a lot easier to tell him stuff. Cause I was like, well, I've never done anything that bad. So this should be easy. But the end, the really great part came after I told him all the stuff on the written list. He said, all right, have you told me everything? And I said, yeah. And he goes, all right, now I want you to tell me the stuff, you know, you're going to take to your grave, the stuff you didn't write down. He's like, because that's the real stuff that's going to get you drunk. And right then and there, like, I knew that I hadn't told him everything. And I knew that he knew that I hadn't told him everything, you know. So that's where, you know, I started telling him those things. And those things were, he was right, those things are the things that were going to get me drunk. And I didn't remember them, a lot of them, that night. The next day, I was like, hey, I forgot to tell you this. And that was what really opened, you know, I think, I really, as the book talks about it, I felt like the obsession to drink kind of was being lifted. And I went home after, like the book says, and, you know, spent an hour just looking over my inventory, seeing did I miss anything in this fourth step in this inventory. And, you know, and I got on my knees and I said to God, you know, God, I'm ready for you to remove all these things, you know, root and branch. And, you know, and that was actually, believe it or not, I pondered there for a second, because, I mean, for me, it was like, yeah, I came here and I saw you guys were happy and you guys had what I wanted. But on the other hand, this was still a leap of faith. I didn't know if this was going to work for me. I was like, you know, I still, my character defects, you know, they make me unhappy, but they're still, at least I know what they're like. You know, it sounds like twisted, but it made me ponder for a second. But I did say the seventh step prayer, and it didn't immediately go away, my character defects. And so I called my sponsor and I was like, hey, what's up with this? You know, God didn't remove these character defects. And he's like, well, God removed them on his time, not your time. And that helped me a lot, because I was just, you know, hey, come on now, you know, why am I still in fear? And for me, you know, a lot of my character defects have to, you know, financially, self-centered fear, including, like, you know, financial fear, you know, fear of inadequacy, and those things are just, you know, I was like, hey, why are they still around, God, you know? But then doing the eighth step, I remember I called my, you know, he gave me he basically said, you know, like it says in the book, you know, you already have a lot of this list when you did your fourth step. I mean, it's the same, a lot of it's the same people. but you know, there's other people too. There's other people you've harmed who you're not resentful at. And I remember like calling, I called him at 2 a.m. one night because I was like, hey, listen, I just thought of somebody who, like, I can't make an amends to this person. I mean, there's just no way I can do this because if I do, then I'll go to, you know, I lose my job, I'll go to jail, and then, and he's like, hey, look, we're just making a list here, okay? And that, I mean, that didn't really help. I mean, I wanted an answer. I was like, but when we get to step 9, you know, am I going to have to make, you know, because I'll get a different sponsor if I have to. Like, I'll just go sponsor shopping. But no, in all honesty, like, it was great because eventually, you know, some of them I did have to make the direct amends to, and some of them, you know, I made an indirect amends to. Instead of, you know, coming up to them and saying, hey, you know, I did blah, 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 you know, I was able to do something else, you know, like charity work or whatnot, or just write a letter. And so that was a great experience too. And, the 9-step promises the book talks about too. But anyway, so I, having done all that, then I do 10, 11, and 12 on a regular basis. And 10, 11, and 12 really are, you know, something I try and do every day. And I'm not perfect at it. Some of you guys know me, and, I come here, and some days it's like, hey, Kian, how you doing? I mean, I was talking about this today with some friends, and I'll be like, hey, I'm doing great. And then, and the next day, okay, that's the day I'll be doing great. Next day I'll be like, feeling like crap. Hey, Kian, how you doing? I'm doing great. Anyway, I have this tendency to wear a mask, you know, but you guys are able to, a lot of people I know, they can totally see it. They're like, no, you're not. you know, what's wrong? What's bugging you? But when I do 10, 11, and 12, you know, like selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, those are the four things that really just either get me, like, you know, get me totally out of focus and spiritually unfit. And I have to, when those things crop up, you know, our book talks about, you know, I can do three things when that happens. And one is to, you know, call another alcoholic, call Jorge or call some other friends and say, hey, look, you know, I'm feeling like resentful of my boss. You know, he's making me do this and what a, you know, I can't stand the guy. Or, you know, and then another thing is to ask God, you know, say a prayer and ask God to remove it. And the other thing is to, you know, help another alcoholic. You know, and that's something that it was not in my DNA to help other people. When I got here, I wanted you to help me so I wouldn't have to drink anymore. And then I was out of here. You know, it was all about me. But today it's not all about me. It's about helping, you know, to help other people the way I was helped. Because that guy who helped me that first night, I mean, he spent 4.5 hours talking to me, and he was just like, you know, depends on you, man. You know, do you still need me to talk to you? And I mean, there's no way I can, you know, pay back that kind of debt. So, you know, I have to remember those three things on a regular basis, to talk to another alcoholic, because once I get it out of me, if, you know, that resentment, that fear, then it doesn't have the same control over me, you know, once it's out. And then once I, you know, say a prayer to my higher power, then that can help a lot too. And then the 11th step, you know, I have to ask my higher power on a regular basis to direct my thinking. Because my thinking, when I direct my thinking, it's not good. It's usually like, you know, hey, look at the beer's on sale today. You know, or like this guy I work with, he's an asshole. Hopefully I'll do better than him this year at work and make more money than him, you know. That's where my thinking goes. And I don't have to, you know, I've had, as the step 12 talks about, a spiritual experience as a result of doing these steps. And, you know, our book mentions that's basically a, you know, we replace our old ideas and thoughts are totally replaced with a new set of thoughts. And it, like I said, it's not every day. You know, there's days where I decide not to do the steps, and, you know, just coming to meetings doesn't do it for me. If I don't pray every day and help other alcoholics, those old ideas will come back, and suddenly it's like I'm angry and I'm fearful, and, you know, if I don't quickly do something about it, it's like, hey, the beer's on sale. Look at that. You know, by the way, that was the last time I drank. It was because the beer was on sale. Because, you know, why not drink if the beer's on sale? I mean, that's how my mind is, even though it could kill me, you know. But So, you know, that's what the program has done for me. And, you know, if you guys or anybody here is new, I know there's some newcomers, you know, just stick around, you know, keep coming back. People, this is one of the, I've been in a lot of groups, and, you know, Central's my home group, and some great people here, and, you know, nothing more I can say. So thanks for letting me talk.